Okay, dear students, we have a quick presentation on a matter that is very much in the financial and investment news these days. The great debate over active management of mutual funds or passive management of mutual funds. Now, if you recall, we discussed these mutual funds called index funds, which are passively managed. There's no people in the top hats making house calls on the companies around the world. They're not doing any research. They simply look at these lists, these indices, these indexes of stocks or bonds or whatever the, in our case, stocks, whatever the asset happens to be. And they buy them if they're on the list. And they don't buy them if they're not on the list. We don't need a high-powered college degree and lots of letters next to our name like CFA or CHFA or whatever, certified financial, chartered financial analyst. We don't need those. We only look at the list, and if they're on the list, we buy them. If they're not on the list, we don't buy them. So let's review. Mutual fund, index mutual funds are mutual funds that buy and hold a specific stock, so hold a portfolio of specific stocks or bonds equivalent to those in a specific market index. There's no active management performed. There's no research. So the mutual fund simply buys all the stocks in the Standard & Poor's 500, the Dow Jones Industrial Average, the Russell 2000. What are these? We'll discuss them in detail in the next chapter. One of the problems of putting mutual funds before stocks and bonds is that you mention stocks and bonds quite a bit and attributes, but we haven't covered them yet. So there's other textbooks and other classes where they put mutual funds after stocks and bonds. I don't do that because mutual funds are so important. We want to hit you with them right away. And as we go through our long hikes up the mountain to look at stocks and then the shorter hike up a smaller mountain to look at bonds, you will realize that, you know what, I don't have to do all this. If it turns out you don't like it, don't worry about it. There's mutual funds that'll do it for you. So why would you want an index fund? Well, because they don't have any research, they can offer much lower annual fees. And we saw that in the chat, the presentation on fees, right? And it turns out that many actively managed mutual funds do not beat their respective index. Not a good thing, isn't it? It's not a good thing, but many do. We're going to see many who have in our last presentation. Because of the annual fee, an index fund cannot actually match the market's performance, but it should come very close, providing the annual fee is not excessive. Whereas the actively managed fund could substantially outperform or underperform the market indexes, which is what we saw in our presentation about fees, right? And be careful, some, especially insurance companies, but other entities will try to sneak high fee index funds into your 401k, 403b. Why? Because they can, and they have to make their boat payments. Okay, now, the rationale for index funds came from research done in the late 1960s, early 1970s, that statistically showed that many of the actively managed funds did not beat the market. They put them up against a monkey throwing darts at a dartboard. In other words, just randomly choosing companies. And some beat the market, some beat the random monkeys, and some didn't. However, what we find when we do our diligent research is that many actively managed funds do beat their respective indices over statistically significant periods of time. We're talking decades. Some of these have beaten their index over decades. Yeah, not just 1 year, folks. We, as investors, in my humble opinion, want to look for a fund family, a family of funds, and we'll discuss family of funds in our next presentation, where most all funds have consistently beat their respective indices over decades. And for several years in the 1980s and 90s, index funds were considered, you know, the best way to invest until they became victims of their own success in the late 1990s. And I believe, and we're going to take a look at a graphic that supports my opinion, that it's happened again. Index funds have become victims of their own success. Slide number 59 shows the very popular indexes that are used by index funds. The one that is the most popular is the Standard & Poor's 500. What is it? It's just a list of the 500 largest companies in the United States. That's all it is. It's changed over time quite a bit. For a while there, they let some foreign companies in, but not anymore. But this is the gold standard. Did you beat the S&P 500? The Dow Jones Industrial Average is another storied, long-lived, in fact, it's second oldest index out there. And we'll discuss that in detail in the next chapter. And then there's the Total Stock Market Index, which used to be called the Dow Jones Wilshire 5000, which used to be called the Wilshire 5000. I wish they just called it the Wilshire 5000. And then the NASDAQ, technology-driven, the MSCI World and IFA. These are global and international. And we're going to study these in detail in our next chapter. But when you go through the thrift savings plan assignment, you're going to see that those are index funds and they are tied to a couple of these indices that you're seeing on this sheet. There are now hundreds of indexes out there. Right. And some are very, very concentrated. So I'm personally not a big fan. I tell you my biases up front. But when you go on the telly and the infernal net, you're going to see the talking heads and the self-appointed experts, pundits, and the like saying that index are the perfect investment. Nobody can beat the market. Well, they're lying, obviously, people have. IFA.com is one of those that wants to sell you their services. Indexed Fund Advisor, it stands for. Well, look, folks, no investment is perfect, all right? No, we humans have never created anything perfect. And so index funds have their downsides. Which we'll take a look at in just a moment. But hang on, before we do that, exchange-traded funds, which we talked about in our first presentation, are the new kid on the block. Well, they've been around 30 years now. And they are, as you recall, open-end mutual funds that trade like a closed-end mutual fund on the stock exchange. They're open-end mutual funds, and there's no limit to the number of shares, but you don't buy them through the mutual fund company. You buy them through your brokerage firm. They've become very popular because people have started using them as trading vehicles. Jack Bogle, the co-founder of Vanguard Funds and one of the first retail index fund, the Vanguard Index 500, was not a big fan of ETFs. And the reason was because people use them as trading vehicles, and he hates trading. He's like me. Are you an investor or are you a trader? And so these things are now bought and sold throughout the day by people thinking they're going to outgun the high-speed frequency trading firms, which are using computers to trade millions of trades a day. ETFs started out as passively managed index funds. So many people believe that ETFs are index funds in that there's no active management. This is not true anymore. At first, yes, it was true. But now more and more ETFs are coming out that are actively managed. So you can see all the confusion around these things. They are not traditional open-end or closed-end mutual funds. They're a hybrid. And they started out as all passively managed, but now there are many actively managed. The best part of ETFs, though, in my humble opinion, is they have really cool names like Spider and Diamond and Cube. I think that's the best part of ETFs. Anyway, so what's wrong, Payano? Why are you stirring up this controversy when the rest of the world is saying, oh, you only should invest in the Standard & Poor's 500 index fund. You don't have to do any active management, and those active managers simply can't beat the index. Slide 61. Now, this is a slide, folks. Relax. I know, what is PE? What is the MSCI, EFA? What is this? We're going to come back to this slide later on in the semester, after we've did our long hike up the mountain on stocks. But what happens is sometimes an index becomes skewed. You know what that word means? Bent out of shape. Toward a particular sector of the economy or region of the world. And we'll discuss the manias that happen within markets when we're working through stocks. So this graphic might not make sense to you because we don't know what a price-to-earnings ratio is, but these are two very popular indices. The Morgan Stanley Capital International, and you don't have to remember that. EFA, I've also heard it pronounced EFI, but it stands for Europe, Australia, and the Far East. Essentially, this index is trying to measure what's going on outside the United States. Remember, international stocks, foreign stocks, overseas stocks. And the Standard & Poor's 500, the 500 largest companies based in the United States. Well, sometimes these things get bent out of shape. Most of you weren't around yet, but in the 1980s, it wasn't China that was going to take over the world, it was Japan. And there was even a song, in the pop song in the culture of the United States, called I'm Turning Japanese. And the stock market in Japan went in two directions, way up and way, 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 way up, to the point where it was just completely absurd. The stock market, the Japanese stock market, was worth more than most other stock markets all combined. It was just very absurd. And many people were saying, you know, this isn't going to last. But it kept going until it stopped. And it stopped at the end of the 1980s. At that time, you maybe bought an index fund that was foreign, that was international, that was outside the United States, an EFA fund, an EFI fund. And you thought you were getting a broadly based, diversified index fund because, hey, it's everybody outside the United States. Canada, at the time, it was Canada, South Africa, Western Europe, Hong Kong, Australia, Singapore, and of course, Japan. Did I miss anybody? It was the developed world outside the United States. Remember, this is before the fall of the Berlin Wall. So it was still there was the first world, and then there was the communist bloc, as it was called, or the second world, and then there was the third world, which we call now the developing markets. But no, you weren't diversified. What had happened is thoroughly 60%, almost two-thirds of your portfolio was based in Japan, whereas 40% was everybody else, Canada, Western Europe, South Africa, who else? I'm forgetting somebody. Australia, Hong Kong, Singapore, Japan. I'm forgetting one developed market at the time. My apologies. So that was 40% of your portfolio. Now, what does PE stand for? Well, price to earnings ratio is a measure of how risky your investment is, how much risk you're taking. The higher the PE, the higher the risk. And also the higher the interest of potential investors, because they think things are going well, so they're willing to bid up the price relative to the earnings. And if you don't understand what I'm talking about, don't worry, we're going to get to it in detail in the coming chapters when we just talk about stocks. But folks, 51.9 is very high. It's very high. It's nosebleed. You're looking down for very far up, and if things go wrong, the parachutes had better be very large, because you got a long way to fall. And sure enough, over the next few years, the Japanese stock market fell over 80%. Right, because it just, was it too late to get in? Was it too late to get out? And it has not come back to where it was at the end of the 1980s yet. It's close, it's getting closer. But Japan has been in a decades-long funk of the stock market because of that party that was the 1980s. There's an old saying, the bigger the party, the longer the hangover. And then the same thing happened 10 years later. The Standard & Poor's 500 index from 1982 or so till almost 2000, March of 2000, went in two directions, up and way up. And many of you, again, weren't even around yet, but it was the new economy, dot-com revolution, Amazon.com, who else .com, lots of dot-com companies, most of which are all gone. And people talked about the old economy. Oh, you don't want old economy stocks like railroads and energy stocks. Ooh, boo. And so the same thing happened. The companies in the Standard & Poor's 500 that were associated with technology, the new economy, were bid up to a PE of almost 60, higher than the Japanese stocks. And in the United States, the information technology sector made up one-third of the Standard & Poor's 500. Now remember, the Standard & Poor's 500 consists of the 500 largest companies in the United States. So we're talking about everybody else, healthcare and basic materials, chemicals, real estate, the financial services, everybody else was in the two-thirds portion with a fairly high PE of 19, but not that high. Oh, by the way, the PE of everybody else in the developed world outside the United States in the 80s was only 13, which is actually very reasonable. So again, you thought you were getting a very wildly diversified index in the S&P 500. And no, you were concentrated in technology stocks. What happened next, right? Between March of 2000 and October of 2002, when the market hit bottom after almost three years, the S&P 500 lost almost 50%. It just barely touched 50%. But the technology sector, as measured by the NASDAQ, which we'll discuss in the next chapter, the NASDAQ index, had gone from 800 in 1995 to 5,000 in March of 2000, and then fell 80% to 1,200, a little under 1,200. So yeah. Ooh, 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 is it too late to get in? Oh, is it too late to get out? And folks, the same thing's happened right now. The same thing has happened. And we're going to take a look at a graphic, and let me see if I get this right here, folks. Let me make sure. Okay. Here, I messed it. I did. Oh, I can't believe I did that. I just deleted it. Let's see if I can get it back here. Come on, sweetheart. Come on, honey. You got to talk nice to your computer. And then we're going to pull it out here because we have to get it a little. Come on, Joe. Why do I have such trouble with computers? I don't know. Here you go. And it did it again. I'm messing it up here. Here you go. I can't get it to work right. I apologize. Okay, come on. Move over just a little bit. Thank you. There you go. That'll work. That'll work. Let's see if I can get this to go down a little bit. Okay, my apologies. Oh, dear. Okay, that's about as good as I'm going to get it. My apologies. Actually, let's get rid of this guy and move this up. Oof. Me and technology don't get along anymore. We used to, but not anymore. Okay, this is from a company called Capital Group, American Funds. It's one of the mutual fund companies out there. They've been around for decades. They're not the only one. They're very good. They've been around for many years. But they're more old school. Boring, which is what I like. T. Rowe Price, Dodge & Cox. I love boring mutual fund companies. And what they're not the only ones that have done this. There's another one that's a few years old that I'm not going to show you from Franklin Templeton. And it wasn't even as bad. This is really bad. It was about 5-6 years ago. It was bad. Now it's even worse. Remember, the Standard & Poor's 500 is a list of the 500 largest companies in the United States. But it is what we call market weighted, which is a fancy way of saying the bigger you are, the more influence you have in the index. And some of these companies, they are now called the Magnificent Seven. For a while, they were called the Fangs or Fang, whatever. And so these seven companies make up a disproportional amount of the index. Remember, there's 500 companies. And in the assignments, there's a bonus assignment. And it'll take you 5 or 10 minutes. And I think it's illuminating. I ask you to find the 10 largest companies. Be careful, because Alphabet, which is Google, is actually two different companies. So you actually have to find the top 11 companies. But here, they're just doing what's now called the Magnificent Seven. Apple, Microsoft, Google, Amazon, NVIDIA, Tesla, and Facebook, Meta. And so out of the 500 companies, fully 27 or so percent, almost 27% is made up of seven companies. And you're going to find it's even more for the top 10 companies. Oh, I'm buying 500 companies, but seven of them make up almost 30% of the index. That's not good. That's not, in my humble opinion, that's not diversification. But hey, everyone's different. But here's the kicker. These seven companies make up over 70% of the return, or made up. This is from January of 2023 to end of June of 2023. Last year, those companies made up 70-some percent, 73, whatever, 74% of the return. What does that mean? It means that people are concentrating and bidding up the prices and making these companies more expensive and more expensive and more expensive. And so that your return is coming from a tiny portion of companies. Now, here's the key of the thing about index funds. As you are the index fund manager, you look at the list and you see that Apple is, you know, 7.72% or whatever it is. It's changed. It's not the same because this was, you know, end of June of 2023. You have to basically do your best to keep your index 7.72% Apple and 6.81% Microsoft and whatever. So as these companies grow in value because people buy them more and the price goes up, you have to increase your percentage. So it becomes a feedback mechanism because then you have to buy, which increases the price, which means that that company is now worth more in the index, which means all the other index managers have to buy. And of course, that raises the price. So more investors get excited because look at how well the Standard & Poor's is doing. They pour more money in and now you have to buy more shares, and you see what's happening. In electronics, it's called a feedback mechanism. It's like a balloon. They just keep pumping it up. And your manager can't say, you know what? Apple's a great company. Microsoft's a great company. These are all great companies, but they're way too expensive. Just as the index fund managers could not do that in Japan in the 1980s and could not do that at the end of the 1990s, they have to buy more shares. It's part of the index, the provisions in the index funds prospectus that they have to follow. You see what's going on? The parachutes had better be very, very large. And I'm not trying to disparage these companies. They're all great companies. I'm a little bit worried about Mr. Elon Musk going off the rails, but what he's built has been an unbelievable juggernaut. Now, what happens on the downside? Right. When a company hits on whatever Boeing, whatever the bolts are all falling off the car, the planes, and the stock falls precipitously, the index fund manager now has to sell, has to get their index, their portfolio in line with the index. They can't say, you know what, this is a great company. They have 10 years of backlogged orders. You order a 737 today, you ain't going to get it for 8, 9, 10 years. And so they can't buy the shares because they're low. They have to sell the shares. So the same thing, that same feedback mechanism happens in reverse as the stock spirals down. So that's why when people ask me, and if they will listen to me long enough for me to explain it, I'm not a big fan of index fund managers, the index funds, because they do what Benjamin Graham said many years ago not to do. He said many years ago, and this was when, you know, math formulas were abounding in the investment world. He said, do not use any strategy that removes human judgment. I think that's wise advice. Having said that, it ain't easy, as we're going to see when we get to picking stocks, folks. Picking stocks is not easy. And some people don't do a very good job of it, but some do. And our job as mutual fund managers is, in my humble opinion, is to find those managers that have done a good job over decades in good markets and bad markets. Are you with me? Does it make sense? I hope so. Because in our next presentation, we're going to see some. We're going to see some companies that have been around for decades and have done well in good times, and more importantly, have done well in bad times. So stick with us, dear students. You are rising investment gurus. We shall reveal all to you, and you will be so amazing. Your friends, family, and coworkers will be so proud of you. I am already proud of you, and everyone at Southwestern will be proud of you. See you in our last presentation when we take a look at fund families and then focus in on a single mutual fund with 90 years of history. Thank you so much for being in our class.